Naturally Speaking.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Naturally Speaking. My name's Sean Killen, and today you're in for a special treat. We're talking about statistics. Don't run away. We're not doing a statistics lecture here. We're going to be talking about a pretty controversial topic in statistics and the way that science is actually done. So maybe we'll get into some arguments. It could be some swearing, maybe some fighting, potentially, if we're lucky. So here with me, I've got a round table here to discuss some of these controversies in statistics and science. I've got with me James Grecian, who's a postdoc here in the department, seabird ecologist. Do you come across p-values and statistics much in your work, James?
Every day.
Well, you're here to talk about them some more here. Also with us is Paul Johnson, who's a research fellow here in our department. Paul, your background is in genetics, correct?
Yes, genetics, population genetics, and statistics. So I kind of produce p-values a lot.
You're sort of an all-around statistician these days, right?
Yeah. So.
People coming to you asking about, there's a baby crying in the background, hearing us talk about statistics, they're becoming scared. But yeah, so a lot of people come to you and ask you about statistical issues quite often.
Yes.
And then finally with us here from University of Roehampton, Lewis Halsey, tell us a little bit about your work that you normally do, studying animal energetics.
Yeah, so I normally study animal energetics.
Right.
Normally vertebrates, not always, and actually sometimes seabirds, although I'm not really a seabird sort of specialist,
yes.
But I know a little bit about them, not as much as James, no doubt, but I will be going off to the Caribbean in June to be studying them some more, just sort of throw that in there.
Fantastic.
Nice.
Yeah.
How dare you.
So normally that's what I'm, so I'm a whole animal biologist taking interest particularly in energetics.
Right.
That's what I normally do.
So you're not a statistician.
I'm not a statistician, no.
And yet you've recently had a paper in Nature Methods where you open up a can of worms, a controversy surrounding sort of a pillar in science, or it has become sort of a pillar in how science is done and how conclusions are formed in science. And that's this use of p-values to infer conclusions or meanings or sort of meaningfulness in data. Do you want to, I guess we should start off by just talking a little bit about what p-values actually are and how they've started to become used in science the way they're used today.
Okay, so I'll try and talk to that. So I've kind of lifted the can on some worms, which was very slightly open, and some specialist statisticians and maybe a few other enlightened people seem to be aware of the can, but not many people at all very well. And hopefully the paper, which actually says nothing that's entirely new. Hopefully it says a few things sort of fairly clearly. That's the point. Pulls a few ideas together which some people may not have been aware of. So it's based on this issue of p-values, which I guess more or less anyone who's done any stats will have heard of p-values, and if, at least heard of them if not use them. And they seem to be the basis for most statistical analysis in most areas of science, at least within biology. They're based around the idea of using probabilities to infer how likely it is that there's really an interesting pattern, interesting signal in your data. Because when a scientist collects data, of course they can only collect a limited amount of data, they can't measure everything that's out there that's interesting to them, so they tend to measure a sample of those data. So although they'd like to know about a pattern in general, the patterns in general in the world, they can't actually know that directly because they can only sample some of their data. So they say, okay, well how well can I infer, how confident I can be that my sample is actually representative of the pattern more generally in the world, and that use frequentist statistics are based on probability, come to some sort of conclusion about how confident they can be that any pattern they find in their sample, so maybe a difference between two groups, for example, how likely that is to actually also exist in a broader sense.
So when we kind of, you start doing maybe undergraduate or maybe even when you're doing A-level maths, you'll do some kind of simple experiment where you go out and you sample a couple of groups, say heights of people, and you could compare those two groups, say men and women, and you would use a p-value in some kind of test to decide whether or not those two groups of heights were different.
Yes, yeah, spot on, perfect example.
Right, so, and that's sort of how they're used today, as I mentioned in science. A lot of times it comes down to just looking at this p-value to tell you whether or not there is actually a difference between the heights of men and women, or the food preferences of one type of seabird and another. And it often comes down to using sort of threshold p-value for telling you whether or not to, I guess, consider whether or not there's a difference actually there.
So there's quite a deep history to this. There's I'm not a historian of science or a historian of anything, but maybe from around the 1930s or so, there was some at least popularising of the p-value, and famously Ronald Fisher was the lead on that, but not the only person. And there were a couple of systems set up by different people for kind of interpreting a p-value, and over the years they've kind of become blended together. And so what people tend to do who want to use p-values to interpret their data, and most people who use p-values, including myself, are not particularly mathematically strong, like a nice simple system saying, you know, if the p-value is high, I don't have really any evidence for a difference. And if the p-value is low, I've got good evidence for a difference. And that's kind of been simplified down further to a significant result. There's good evidence that there's a difference based on my sample, or a non-significant result. There's not good evidence, mm-hmm. so there's a difference based on my sample.
So there's very strict cutoffs. Like you'll say,
black and white,
if your p-value is 0.05 or it's below 0.05, that's when you say, oh, we found something interesting
here. Yeah,
that
tends to be the threshold. Yeah. If it's 0.05, it's lower than 0.05, people tend to say, yeah, I found something. And if it's higher, people tend to say, I haven't found something. That would be the crudest and probably the most common way of interpreting the p-value.
And right. The crazy thing is people will use that even if p is 0.04 or 0.06.
Yes.
So this is where we're sort of getting into why these p-values can be so controversial. And so I guess this is where your paper, Lewis, comes along.
Yeah, so one issue, as James points out straight away, is, okay, well, what's the right cutoff to have? What's that right point to say? What's the correct sort of p-value to say, okay, if it's lower than that, we've got a significant result. If it's higher than that, we've got a non-significant result. It's an arbitrary choice of 0.05. And then beyond that, whatever your choice is, then it seems a bit iffy to say, well, okay, if it's just a teeny bit below that, yeah, we've got a result. And if it's a teeny bit above that, we haven't got a significant result. That's a problem. That issue becomes exacerbated when, and this is kind of what the paper's showing, when we then realise that the p-value is what I've called very fickle. So it'll spit around all over the place, around the value you get. So if you run an experiment, okay, and you measure the height of men and women, and you get a p-value of 0.03, so you get a significant difference in the height between men and women. If you run that analysis again, so you take a new sample of men and women, same sample size, from the same populations, you run that analysis again, your p-value could be more or less anything. Whereas I think people typically, at least implicitly, assume that if they got a p-value of, say, 0.3 first time around, they're going to get something somewhat similar to that next time. If they got a p-value of 0.8, they might get something similar to 0.8. If they got a p-value of 0.01, they'd get something similar to 0.0. The reality is they could get almost anything, you know, from the range of 0 through to 1. And so, simply put, that makes the measure almost untenable, because from one measurement to the next, you're getting completely different values.
Right. And so how did you go about showing this in your Nature Methods paper?
Right. Well, I just ran some basic Excel models to start with, where I just kept creating random data based on some populations which I knew the parameters. And then someone who's on the paper, Doug Curran Everett, who is actually a statistician, knows how to do this. He's probably then running much better than me and producing beautiful graphs, which are in the article. So that's great. But basically, it's based on modelled data. So it's just two populations. We want to see if there's a difference between them. We know the background behind the populations, and we just keep running iterations of an experiment where we sample from those two populations and then run a t-test to see if there's a difference. Right. And the p-value over and over and over again is really different. And it's not because these populations are very similar. You know, the standard deviation between them, the absolute effect size, so the absolute difference between these two populations is common to what you would find in standard experiments.
Right.
And yet the p-value is very, very fickle. Right. I mean, it's like going in your car and you get it up to 100 miles an hour, and the next time you can only get it to 50 miles an hour, and the next time you get it to 150 miles an hour. You don't really know, right, you know, how fast you're going to be able to go next time you get in the car. It's just, right, pointless.
And so you guys were really only able to detect this because you basically simulated two populations, and then you were able to repeatedly sample those populations over and over and over and over again.
It's a really pernicious thing is that most of the time, most of us will run an experiment once.
Yeah, exactly.
And get a result, and then we move on. I mean, it's not always the case, but it's typically the case.
Right.
Here, what we're able to do is take almost that overview. We're looking down, if you like, on this situation where we can run the experiment many, many times, thousands of times. and see what would happen if that was a reality. And right. as I say, you just get a p-value that's different every time. So then if you're doing your third year dissertation or your PhD thesis or whatever it is, a report for the council, and you do that study once, it's almost, all bets are off what p-value you're going to get. Are you going to be able to report some exciting result, or are you going to have to say there's nothing there? And it's really just down to chance in most cases. That would be my argument.
Right.
Which is obviously quite controversial and strong.
Slightly contentious.
Yes.
But it's backed up by the simulations you've done. I mean, you can't really argue with what you found. I mean, you're simulating studies as a kind of realistic sample sizes with realistic differences between the populations, and these are the kind of studies where they're not so large that you're going to get really, really strong evidence from them. You're quite likely to get, if you do get a significant result, so a p-value of less than 0.05, then it's quite likely to be 0.4 or 0.03.
Right.
So for studies of this sort of size, this is where Lewis has found that if you do this again, then your p-value could be pretty much anywhere from zero to one.
That's a scary thought. And it also kind of reminds you of how there's so many logistical constraints when you're doing experiments in science. You can often only do an experiment once. When another one of the tenets of science is meant to be that, something should be reproducible, and there should be a consensus that's built around reproducibility in different labs doing the same experiment. But oftentimes that doesn't happen.
Well, no, absolutely. I mean, we're driven, aren't we, by the systems, if there are systems, like REF, or what these fancy journals in particular want, or maybe what, in some universities, the politics there, because they're being driven to get money and shall be put. We scientists are pushed towards not repeating stuff, but
towards
actually
novelty.
Going for novelty. Yeah, novelty's a word, and big steps forward, right? You're taking big steps based on something with a rickety p-value. You can take a few more steps forward and then look back and the whole thing has fallen below you like a house of cards. You're not necessarily... The giants upon which shoulders you're standing may have very dodgy knees.
Right, right. That's a good way to put
there's
it.
There's an image for you.
Because there's always going to be a difference, right? When you take any two groups of anything, of men and women heights.
So it seems that the p-value, that the way I sort of try to look at it, but again, I mean, I'm not a mathematician, so I'm limited here, but there seems to be a high gearing between variation in sample that you get and what happens to the p-value. In other words, a bit of a change in the sample that you pull out from the population each time you run an experiment, a little bit of a change there can have a big change on the p-value.
Right.
So, and because when you come back to the experiment, you're resampling and getting a new sample, it's very likely that the p-value at the end of the process is going to change a lot. Yeah.
Right.
But one thing that you maybe want to start talking about is the role that sample size can play in this. So one of the things that you did in this study was you then started ramping up your sample size. And obviously you can never wholly, it's very unlikely that any study will wholly sample an entire population. So, but there's a chance that you can increase the numbers of samples that you take from that population. And you would hope that when you start to get to much larger sample sizes, that you'll have fewer or much better chance of getting a significant p-value if there's an effect there.
Yes, and that's absolutely right, and we do show that. So, I mean, it's intuitive and it comes out in the maths that as you increase sample size, you start to hone in a bit better on any difference that there is between the populations because your sample's bigger and bigger and bigger, so you're getting a better and better description of the populations. And through doing that, you're increasing the power of your study. So the power of your study, by definition, is the probability that if there is an effect, if there is a difference between the two groups, for example, that you will pick that up in your analysis as a significant result. You will get a significant result when you compare your sample. And so if you increase the sample size, you'll get that. And also, in fact, as you increase the sample size, the fickleness of P decreases. So if you were to run that study lots of times, p-value becomes less fickle. I mean, most people don't run the study lots of times, but if you... So you can start to be a bit more confident about the p-value that you've got, that if someone came along and reproduced your experiment with the same sample size, they'd get a similar result. However, the kicker is that by the time your power is high enough, in other words, your sample size is big enough that your power is high enough that your p-value starts to stabilize, you don't need to run any statistical analysis anyway, because if you just plot the data...
Paul, a statistician's like, no!
It's one bar chart high. Well, this is a... So we can... Yeah, maybe this is something we can disagree on. One bar is up here and the data points are there and the other bar's down here. So you look at it And as Jeff Cummings called it, it smacks you between the eyes. You really don't need a p-value of 0.0001 to tell you there's a difference. But, so it becomes then defunct in that situation.
But is there also an issue in that this is slightly different from power, but because power involves effect size, but also the more and more samples you take, eventually you're going to detect a difference there statistically with respect to p-values and significance. But it might not mean anything biologically or in terms of whatever it is you're actually interested in. We were talking about this earlier, Lewis, and you give the example of you could stand out by the motorway and count blue and green cars. Do you want to give that analogy again?
So if you want to know if blue cars go faster than green cars, I guarantee to you there is a difference in the speed that they go, even though there's no reason why there should be a priori, because from random chance, even if they've got the same engines in them on average, right, blue and green cars, and they probably basically do, there's going to be some degree of difference. There's going to be some difference in the mean between the average speed that the blue and green cars are going. There just will be. Even if it's to a tiny, tiny decimal place of miles per hour, there's going to be a difference. So if you measure enough cars, you will come out with a statistically significant difference between them. If your sample size is big enough, you will do that. And you could argue, therefore, that when you get a significant result, what you're really showing is that your sample size was big enough to show the difference between the two groups,
right,
which is inevitably there.
Right.
So there is an issue there, maybe. I mean, it's not quite what's stated in the paper, but you could argue that typically if you pump up the sample size enough so that your p-value stabilizes, you're also going to find a significant result, regardless of whether it's interesting.
Right.
Then you really want to look at the effect size, of interest, because if the difference in the speed of the cars is 0.1 miles an hour, who cares?
Yeah. You're sort of furrowing your brow, Paul. Do you disagree with any of this?
I agree.
Oh, I was hoping for a disagreement here.
No, I was trying to think of what the kind of attacks on p-values are so far. So we have the attack on the arbitrary threshold of, you know, you've got strong evidence if your p-value is below 0.05 and no evidence if it's above 0.05, which is silly. Then you have the unreliability of the p-value. The problem is that people invest too much certainty in a p-value that, you know, of say 0.03,
right,
a p-value that isn't terribly low. They see that as kind of strong evidence when really it's quite weak evidence, and the proof that it's weak evidence could be seen by looking at Lewis's, it's not highly repeatable. You know, so really scientists need to kind of recalibrate their evidenceometers to not take a p-value that's slightly less than 0.05 as strong evidence.
Right.
It really just means, you know, mildly surprising.
Right.
But if you I think actually one kind of facetious solution to this would be to go through the entire scientific literature and do a find and replace of significant for mildly surprising, and then reread the paper, and you'll get a more realistic idea of the strength of the evidence.
Yes, that's an excellent point.
Yeah, that would be an interesting exercise for sure. There was another recent paper that came out, sort of getting back to this idea about threshold p-values and that determining sort of the be-all, end-all, the conclusions that are made in a given study. There was another paper that came out in PLOS Biology recently where they discussed this idea of p-hacking, where researchers sort of unconsciously or consciously will sort of manipulate their studies or go back and collect more data or do various things so that they can try and get their p-value below this threshold of 0.05. Yeah, I mean, is this tied in directly with this issue of using this threshold cutoff?
Yeah, I think it's not really. I mean, that isn't really an issue with p-values. That's an issue with having a threshold when very often you don't need a threshold. I mean, this relates to what Lewis was saying, that when you produce a p-value as some kind of measure of the strength of evidence that there is a pattern there, what you're doing is you're assuming that you're proposing a null hypothesis, so it's a hypothesis that there's no difference at all, and then you're sort of trying to gauge the amount of evidence against the hypothesis that there's no difference. And very often, as Lewis says, with the different colored cars, you know, it's extremely unlikely that this null hypothesis is true. So there really isn't any point in testing hypotheses that have no chance of being true. In that situation, what you really want to be doing is as Lewis was saying, measure the effect size. Get some measure of the size of the difference,
right,
with some idea of how of uncertainty of sort of precision around that, which would be a confidence interval.
Right. We'll come back around to that a bit later. Let's put a pin in that. We'll talk about alternatives to p-values a bit later, but I guess, is there anything to say in defense of the p-value? I mean,
if it's used as Fisher, who was mentioned earlier, if it was used as I haven't read his book entirely, and never will, but if it's used in the way he advocates and sort of almost the origin, if you like, of the p-value, I think it's quite good. And actually, that comes back to what Paul said, which is, you know, if there's a, in different words, you know, if there's a value of around 0.05-ish, then the data's getting interesting. Maybe there's something going on. It's a little bit surprising. You know, take another look, collect more data, maybe explore that avenue. And if it's much less than that, then you've got a bit more evidence. But again, play it cautiously. I mean, this is what Fisher says. I don't think, from what I understand, that Fisher was probably a genius. But of course, he didn't have the computer. He didn't have a computer at all in his day. And I don't think he was probably aware of how fickle P can be. But you know, the way he was very cautious about it and said it could be used as a pointer. And if that was done today, I think we'd be okay.
So a pointer for replicating that study?
So rather than the way that we're more or less indoctrinated to say, right, if your p-value is less than 0.05, bang, you're in, you've got that. That's yours.
Case
you know,
closed.
You can't lose that. You know, you go home with that, whatever happens next. And then you build on that to the next step. Whereas Fisher's advocating, there's a suggestion there could be something there.
Right.
Let's go and look, see if we can develop more. Or it may well disappear in a puff of smoke because the reality is there's nothing really there. So this attitude, as you were mentioning, going back over the science, looking at it again, building a foundation, looking at it from different angles and developing it on, which unfortunately you're probably not going to get NERC or BBSRC funding to do. So,
but could you simply, I mean, is it something as simple as rephrasing how you describe your results in a paper? So rather than saying we tested this hypothesis, you say we examined the chance of this hypothesis and this is a p-value that suggests there may be something going on. Rather than saying it's black and white, you do say there are however many shades of grey you want.
Yeah, I think there's two reasons that people often write in black and white. One, because they want to give a stronger, clearer argument, because that makes the paper seem better. And also because it's a way of writing concisely. You know, you don't want to waffle and you've got limited space. But absolutely, we should be using more caveats, more qualifiers. Although, you know, there may be some English stylists who don't like that. But we should be writing in a more cautious way.
And I think that's probably one of the reasons why p-values have become so popular, is because they are a way of sort of distilling down very complex experiments and data sets into a simple sort of take-home message that you can put in the title of the paper or the abstract. And
In fact, stats takes quite a lot of skill to do well. Even basic stats takes a huge amount of skill. The reality is, I think, that there's a whole layer of skill and experience needed on top of what we already think is needed to choose the right test and get it into SPSS or R correctly, which is that based on really carefully assessing our data by viewing it, by running statistical tests, by considering it within the context of the science we're doing, and then writing about that accurately, concisely, and eloquently, so that we convey a realistic level of meaning about the data to which we can ascribe, you know?
Right.
And at the moment, people don't tend to do that. They may get the right test. They may get a decent experimental design. They might even get the right test. But I don't think people necessarily are very good at interpreting how strong that data is and weaving that into a discussion that accounts for where it's stronger and where it's a bit weaker.
So we're sort of touching on a little bit earlier when you mentioned funders and sort of their approaches to these things. There's just sort of an ingrained culture in science in using p-values and hypothesis testing in this way. I mean, how do we go about changing this culture then? If there are these issues with p-values, what role do journals play? What role do funders play?
It's quite interesting. There was a recent discussion was kind of sparked off by the journal Basic and Applied Social Psychology. Just an editorial where they announced that they're going to ban p-values from their journal,
right?
And that is one quite extreme approach. I think it's, you know, most people would certainly most statisticians would say that's an overly extreme approach, because I don't think the fundamental problem is with p-values; it's with the the misinterpretation of p-values. Mm. I mean, they're used too much, and when they are, and often they're used badly. Fewer p-values, better interpreted, would be a sort of more nuanced instruction that a journal could give to authors and to reviewers.
Is there a problem there with kind of throwing out one dogma and replacing it with another? I mean, they've said that they're going to ban p-values. Is it just the case now that every paper is going to use AIC or something instead?
I think they encourage confidence intervals, AIC, and...
They banned confidence intervals as well, in fact. As it happens, they've also banned confidence intervals, but that's kind of maybe another story. But there is perhaps that issue. I think... Yes, I mean, this paper briefly touches on other possibilities, not because the paper is about other possibilities, but because it seems a bit rude to say, this is very good, don't use this, and then, you know, what else might you use? And there are lots of other things, so AIC and Bayesian statistics. And the option that this paper does talk a little bit about, which is perhaps the easiest to use, that doesn't necessarily make it the best, is simply effect size combined with...
Paul was mentioning earlier.
And that's very important. So it doesn't address the issue of whether there's one dogma will be replaced with another, but one thing I would advocate is actually moving away from hypothesis testing per se, regardless of whether that involves p-values, because I think it limits, I don't think it accurately reflects what most people want to study most of the time. There are examples of where they do, and perhaps in Paul's area more. But for example, if you want to know the quickest way to get to work, right, and you could take the car, you could take the train, okay, and you think, I don't know which way is quicker, and of course it depends on the traffic and depends on the time of year and stuff. So what I'm going to do is every day I'm going to alternate between taking a car and the train to work. I'm going to time how long it takes me to get from A to B. What isn't that interesting, what isn't that valuable, is to know if there's a significant difference. That's not that useful. Because there could be a really tiny difference. It could be, for example, that after 10 years of measuring how long it's taken to get there, the difference in time is, you know, it takes you 37 minutes exactly by car on average and 37.1 minutes by train on average. And you'd probably get a significant result with that. But that's not going to be too useful to you because that's kind of 10th of a minute, 6 seconds difference. If you ask yourself, what is the effect size, which sounds fancy, but it is just... what is the difference between the mean times of these two transport? If it comes out at a tenth of a minute, then you're probably going to think, actually, it doesn't matter. Time-wise, neither one is better for me. So I'm going to think about other things that might help me decide whether I want to take the car or the train. Like, do I want to work on the way to work? How expensive is it? You know, blah, blah, blah. Do I want the car at lunchtime to get into town? Stuff like this. Yeah. So it gives you a context within which to assess that effect size. Again, you could have a very, very small difference between the two, but you'll find a significant difference if you run enough information, if you collect enough data on the times. So I would say that generalizes to the majority, probably not all, but to the majority of scientific situations where really the question we want to ask is, how big is the difference? And that might sound presumptuous, like, well, you're assuming there's a difference. There's always a difference. As long as you measure enough, accurately enough with your laser or whatever it is, there's always a difference. The question is, are you going to sample enough to get that difference with your p-values? And also, is that difference important? Now, the car train example is an easy one, right? And often in biology, it's not so easy to know what the context is to make a decision on is that effect size big enough. But that's, we need to be asking a research question. Is there, how big is the difference in the time it takes me to get to work between car and train? Not a hypothesis question. Is there a difference in the time it takes me to get to work from versus car versus train?
So you're completely reframing the question, basically.
Yeah, and we're all, most people are indoctrinated into the p-value, and it's quite hard to come out of this. But if we start asking the research question, how big is the difference? Not, is there a difference?
So do you envisage that students might be being taught differently now as more of these papers start to come out, sort of... pointing out the issues with p-values, because it is so ingrained that the people who are going to be teaching them will have grown up in a p-value culture. Or do you have any of you noticed that maybe you're shifting towards a different teaching strategy, or you see that happening in your departments?
I mean, I don't really know much about what goes on in undergraduate teaching, but I would guess that the sort of movement against the p-value is quite recent, and the people who teach statistics are generally probably quite slow to change. So I would be surprised if there'd been any major change. But I mean, there are fields. I mean, there are fields like in ecology where there has been a movement away from using p-values towards other methods of making inferences, such as a measure called AIC. I actually went to a very good talk last week called the cult of AIC, which is basically making the point that you know we've all moved in certain fields of ecology. People started using this other measure, but actually they're just using it in the same way as we're using p-values, and very often they're getting the same results as p-values, so they really haven't changed anything. They just sort of swapped one flawed method of inference that's being used badly for another.
Right. I guess one thing that's useful with something like AIC is that you can rank different models. So say you're looking at some kind of response, you could compare the roles of different variables in trying to explain that response, and you could try and rank a series of different models with differing number of variables. And that's not kind of something you could do in the same way with p-values, but is it a more useful approach than, you know, having all of them in and taking them all out and testing?
Can you get any sort of effect size that way, though, if you're just ranking models?
Not from AIC, but you don't really get an effect size measure. You don't get an effect size measure from a p-value either. Either. So, I would need to think back to this talk. I mean he did show a slide showing that you end up doing broadly when you rank variables using p-values. You can end up doing broadly the same thing. Right. With AIC, but I think that there are things that you can do. I mean, AIC I think is fundamentally less arbitrary than the p-value. There are things that you can do with AICs that you can't do. So you can if you have three models, you can with certain assumptions you can say this model is about 80% likely to be the best one. This one is 50% likely to be the best one, and this other one is 5% likely. And that gives you you don't have to reject any of them. You can just keep them there and present them and say, okay, so that's James is saying, that's kind of the ordering of the likelihood.
Right, but then to build on that, so that's quite nice, the idea. You can have several models to describe your data, and you can put them in order of how likely they are to be the best model, given the different models you've got and the data you've collected, and that's good. But then, to me, that cries out for needing, well, okay, let's take this. Maybe you've got one model, for example, which is head and shoulders, above the rest. That may be okay. Okay, but how good is that model? So it may have finished first in the race, but was it fast, a runner, or were they still a really, really slow runner? Because if they're explaining a very small amount of the variance in the data, so the effect size is very small, then it may be the best, but it may still be very rubbish. And so it's nice. I think AIC is a nice approach, but for me, at least to some extent, the argument would still come back to, okay, well, what's the effect size? So the effect size could be the difference between two groups, or the effect size could be how strong the correlation is, basically. Maybe for these models, it tends to be more how strong the correlation is.
But it seems like...
How strong is that?
Sorry, I was just going to say, maybe it just seems like relying too heavily on any one sort of technique is probably not a wise thing to do. But having all these things in the toolbox and being used appropriately in different combinations and different contexts.
Well, I think that's kind of true, but I'd say I'm being slightly pushy for interest's sake as well, but I'd sort of say that, again, I think we need to be focusing, when we can, on how big the effect size is, because otherwise you can use a p-value or you can use AIC, and they both got their value, and I've certainly used both of them. And you can get focused on a winner and a loser, but you don't know how strong the winner is. And if it's a very weak winner, you know, if someone wins the running race at the local sports day, you're not necessarily picking them for the Olympic team, right? I mean, because they're going to be a long way behind Usain Bolt or whatever it is. So you want to see what that relative is. So I think people should again be asked the question, how strong is the effect? And actually, some people doing complicated models, it's not necessarily that easy to pull those sorts of data out. Okay. So, you know, I don't want to be a kind of stats sort of, you know, police about this, but maybe people should ask to some degree, well, should they be doing models that are that complicated and clever if they can't actually then get reasonable answers out to them? I'm not sure.
Right.
I mean, that's a rhetorical question, I think. But
it seems like AICs can be sort of valuable for honing in on what model you should be considering, and then you delve into a bit deeper.
Maybe you
consider
none of the models if they're all very weak, you see.
But I'm not anti-AIC, I'm just saying barely seems to me. I'm really not, but...
This should be, of course, if you have these three models, as Lewis says, there may be some unconceived alternative model that's much, much better that you haven't tested. But then you need some kind of effect size measure. And there, you know, there are things like R squared, which you know, which is basically a number that goes from 0 to 1, and 1 means that your model's perfect, and 0 means it's not doing anything at all. And so, you can also use these kind of statistics to get some sort of objective assessment of how good your model is.
Right.
And you can kind of combine that with p-values or AIC or whichever approach is appropriate to your analysis.
I think we should probably consider wrapping up here. There's a few less punches thrown there than I hoped for, Lewis. Jeez.
I missed.
Anyway, thanks a lot, guys. What we'll do is we'll post a link to Lewis's paper and other papers that we've touched on and a few other resources on our blog site where the podcast is posted. And thanks a lot, guys. Thanks again for joining us here today. And thanks to you, listeners. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Naturally Speaking podcast. If you've got any ideas for future shows or want to get involved, then please contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is naturallyspeakingpodcast@gmail.com. Naturally Speaking is a podcast from the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine at the University of Glasgow. For more information, you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter @thenspodcast. And you can download future episodes and find more information at our blog at naturallyspeakingpodcast.wordpress.com.